This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast featuring weekly interviews with the most brilliant minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is always free of charge, and unlike the mainstream financial press, we are not a platform for market cheerleading. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the business telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Welcome to Macro Voices, Episode 4, recorded March 3rd, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. This week, we're bringing you Part 2 of our special on trading the coming bottom in oil prices. Last week, Art Berman and I took a deep dive into the fundamentals affecting the oil market. And this week, Nathan and I will be examining trading strategies for the coming bottom from a number of different perspectives.
And I'm Nathan Egger. Eric, let's run down this week's markets. We'll start with equities again.
Okay. Well, I had thought last week that this rally in equity markets was going to be over at the 50-day moving average. That didn't work out. We have advanced all the way to the 100-day moving average. It looks like we're stalling out here. I do think a lot of this has to do with oil markets and the tendency for equities and oil to trade in sympathy with one another. I am hoping that both oil and equities are done here and we're about to see the market roll over to the downside. Then again, I said that last week and it wasn't quite time yet, so we've yet to see what's going to happen here.
We led with equities, but clearly crude is leading the markets. Let's cover that next. Now, last week you said the spin doctors were winning out over the economic fundamentals, which you continue to see as bearish. How's this week looking?
Nathan, it's absolutely shocking this week what's been going on. It's more spin doctors. It's more propaganda. It doesn't have anything to do with economic fundamentals. But here's the thing I want you to hear. It's working. What's happened is we've had first the Russians and then the Venezuelan oil minister this week, or today on Thursday at least, it was Nigeria. Yesterday it was Venezuela. These guys are succeeding at talking the market higher on nonsense, and it's utter nonsense. It has nothing to do with reality. But we're getting to the point now, just teetering on $35 oil prices. We start getting north of 36, Nathan. That's where you get to the point where you're outside of the consolidation range that has been prevailing for the last month or so. That upside breakout would probably trigger a bunch of stops. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a stop clearing run targeting those stops in the area just above 36. So this could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we got a rally going here above 36, before you know it, we could be into the 40s. I do not think that anything has changed in terms of the fundamentals that we talked last week, but there are people with a vested interest in jawboning this market higher, and they are being astonishingly successful despite the fact that they're working from the weakest of arguments. They're talking about a production freeze, which is categorically irrelevant. It doesn't mean anything. There's no reason to take it seriously. But we got a dollar and a half rally today out of the Nigerian oil minister saying, hey, we're still looking at a March 20th meeting. Even that date was later refuted as being made up. But these guys are lying through their teeth. It's working, and they're succeeding at jawboning the market higher. I think it's as high as it can go. We're right at the top of our trading range. I would like to see both equities and crude oil roll over and move lower from here, dramatically lower. I think crude oil has $10 lower to go than it is right now. But for the moment, what we're seeing is all the rhetoric and propaganda from various different small OPEC countries is working, and it's driving the market higher.
Well, there's a common theme that we're seeing here across all of these markets, and that's that they're all at critical points from a technical analysis standpoint, and gold is no different. We've been watching gold's breakout above its 200-day moving average with bated breath for the last few weeks to see if it could sustain a move above 1260. And as we're talking here late session on Thursday, we're at 1260. How is this looking for you? Where do you think gold is headed next?
Yeah, you know, what I was looking for was for gold to break out and close above its previous intraday high, which was right around 1260. As you said, the market is still trading as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. We're at 1260 even right now as we're speaking. Looks to me like this rally does have legs. I was very skeptical initially. I'm still concerned long-term or even intermediate-term that if the downside route in equities resumes, which I think it will, I think that there's a possibility that gold will end up selling off along with equities and everything else if we get into a really heated sell-off. So far, that hasn't happened. And I think we just today, I saw something on Twitter that Luis Yamada, very famous technician who's been around Wall Street for decades and decades, came out as expressing a bullish call on gold. And I think that's the first time since 2011 that Luis has been bullish on gold. So things do appear to be turning. I still have some skepticism about this rally because there are some fundamentals in terms of the U.S. dollar rally, which I don't think is over, that would govern an upside move in gold. But you can't argue with the chart. And right now, what I'm seeing is the breakout is continuing to the upside.
All right. Finally, let's touch on bonds really quick. How are bonds looking to you this week? How do they relate to what we're seeing in oil and the stock market?
Well, we've seen bonds trade off in price, up in yield in reaction to the stock market rallying. I think that that is a reverse safety trade as we're seeing a little bit of confidence in stocks. Some of that panic money that was flowing into the bond market is coming back out into the stock market. I don't think it's going to last a whole lot longer. I said that last week at the 50-day moving average. Now here we are quite a few points higher at almost 1990 on the S&P, just flirting with the 100-day moving average, at least on the futures chart. So I don't know where it's headed, but I think that lower is likely. And if it's going higher from here, I don't think it's going to go too much higher.
All right, Eric. Thanks, as always, for the market perspective. We're going to go ahead and move on now to part two of our special in the coming bottom in oil prices right after this.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now as this week's special guest is, oh wait, it's me, folks. The way things worked out when we decided at the 11th hour to split this topic up into two shows, there wasn't time to recruit another guest to help with this week's analysis. So Nathan and I are going to cover this week's show. Nathan will be interviewing me, and of course the subject is trading strategies for the coming bottom in oil prices, which I discussed with Art Berman last week.
And Eric, probably it's just as well, because this is a subject you're as expert on as anyone we could have hoped to recruit. I'm sure there's somebody better than you out there, but we don't know them. So this week, I'm going to interview Eric, and we'll be coming at the question of how to trade the coming bottom in oil prices from several different angles. So first, we're going to consider how the big boys are playing this, and then we'll come at it from the perspective of a discretionary commodity trading advisor looking to use the futures and options markets to play this coming bottom. And then we'll look at it from the perspective of both the fixed income and equity fund managers, how those two different strategies might differentiate. And finally, we'll look at the question from a retail investor's perspective. So, Eric, let's start off by summarizing the fundamental view that you and Art both agreed upon in last week's show.
Sure. The view that Art and I agree on is that we're in the ninth inning here. This thing is almost over, but it's not over yet. And that's a really important point. Both Art and I think that there is another leg down coming in crude oil prices. We both think it's a big one, and it's not here yet. Much to my surprise, even though this week on Wednesday, we got a 10.4 million barrel build in inventories nationwide. 1.2 million of that was Cushing, Oklahoma build. Now, we've got less than 10 million barrels available in Cushing, Oklahoma that are still remaining capacity. So we used up more than 10% of it this week alone, and the oil market still closed higher. It just blew my mind that that could happen. There was a slight decrease in U.S. production. I imagine that had something to do with it, but I think mostly It's the propaganda, the Nigerian oil minister. You know, the market was starting to crash on that news. And 3 minutes later, the Nigerian minister is out saying, we're going to have a meeting in March and we're going to have a production freeze and the price is going to move sharply after that. Frankly, I think if it were going to move sharply, it would be sharply to the downside. But that's not what he meant. So Art and I both think that it's not over, that there is another really big move down, but we're almost to that washout point. And when we do get to that point, I wouldn't be surprised to see front-month crude oil futures trading below $20 a barrel, and it will be an opportunity of a lifetime. I think both Art and I agree that although we're still bearish, we see that it's not quite over yet. The light's at the end of the tunnel, and when this thing is over, it's going to be the bull market trading opportunity of a lifetime.
Okay, so we know that you and Art both agree, you both share, at least at current, a similar fundamental view, but is there an argument that would contradict that of you and Art?
Well, the contradictory argument that I've become quite concerned about this week is the one that says that the spin doctors might succeed at getting the oil market to recover before the fundamentals dictate that. It's very hard for me to see how they could actually keep prices elevated in the face of these really huge inventory builds. But we saw that here on Wednesday of this week. 10.5 million barrel build, 3 times bigger than any analyst had expected. And the price of oil still closes higher on the day. Just blows my mind. So if these guys continue to fabricate this story, particularly if they can manage to jawbone the market above $36, $36.50 or so, that's where I think a lot of people's stops will be set, because the previous high in this cycle was right at $36. So there's probably a bunch of stops just above $36. Somebody's going to be gunning for them. If they manage to take them out, they could ignite a short squeeze that could carry the market into the 40s. And if they really played the propaganda correctly, they might be able to keep the price up on this idea that supposedly a production cut is coming any day now. There's going to be a meeting. They're confusing, I think, intentionally the phrase production freeze with production cut, trying to make them sound synonymous when they're actually completely opposite, different things. The risk that I see here is that the market could persuade itself that the bottom is already in even before the fundamentals call for that. We could get a short squeeze and a rally up into the 40s, and eventually we will get that production cut. Eventually, Saudi Arabia will capitulate and there will be a production cut. I don't think it's coming for several months. Could the market somehow keep itself elevated for all that time? I don't think so. I'm still short here. I still expect a big move to the downside in crude oil prices. But if something's going to go wrong, it would be the technical breakout above 36 gaining momentum and that becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy where a short squeeze carries the market higher on short squeeze internals, completely independent of fundamentals. That's the what could go wrong for my view. And in that case, what we'd be looking at is it's not the coming bottom in oil prices, but rather the bottom is already in and it's all uphill from here. I don't think it's going to go that way, but if there's something that Art and I could have wrong, I think that would be it.
All right. Well, with that summary of the backdrop of the oil market fundamentals, let's move on to how to trade this. And we're going to start with how the really smart money is playing this. What are the really big players going to do here, Eric? And I think it might also be wise to explain what we mean by really big players. Who are they? Why are we calling them the big guys?
When you talk about really big players, what comes to my mind is the biggest hedge funds, the ones that have complete discretion to do whatever they want, who are looking at this situation. And the really smart guys are not looking to take market risk. They're not looking to speculate. What they want to do is lock in a sure thing. A truly risk-free arbitrage very rarely presents itself in financial markets, because if it's truly risk-free, obviously everybody would be jumping on it. You've got a trade here which is staring the biggest players in the market in the face. And what's so cool about it, if you're the big boys, is that the little guys like me can't touch it. The way this works is let's suppose that in the next month we see the crash in oil prices that both Art Berman and I think is very possible. We see oil prices on the April delivery contract trading all the way down at $16.50, which Art said would be the inflation-adjusted equivalent of an all-time low. So we see that happening. Meanwhile, a year later, the price of the delivery contract for April of 2017 is, say, $10 higher than that, at $27. Well, what the biggest players are going to do is they're going to arbitrage that difference. They're going to say, we're going to buy $16 oil. And at the very same instant, without ever taking any market risk, they're going to sell the $27 oil a year later. Now, that presents a problem, which is, what are you going to do with the oil that you have to buy and take delivery of this April, and you've got to do something with it to store it until next April? Well, what they'll do is they'll charter a very large crude carrier tanker ship, great big ship that normally is designed to carry oil from the Middle East to the Western world where it's consumed. They'll fill it up with oil in Houston, Texas, take it out and anchor it in the bay off of Houston, and it'll sit there for a year, basically serving as a floating gas tank. And they can charter, they have to take the cost of chartering the ship out of their expenses. But after they've done that and paid for some insurance, they pocket the difference. And it's very, very important, because this gets misinterpreted and misreported. You'll hear the Wall Street Journal or the cable channels reporting this as these really big players are buying this cheap oil, putting it in container ships, speculating, hoping that they'll be able to sell it for much more later down the road. That's really not how this trade works. They're selling it the very same day that they bought the oil on the immediate market in the front month contract. They're locking their price in for delivering it a year later, and it's a done deal. They're going to make a fortune on this. All they have to do is have the wherewithal to be able to charter a ship and use it as a gas tank and so on and so forth. Most people can't do that. So the people who really are going to make a killing here are the people that have locked this market up. They knew this was coming. They've spent the last 6 months making deals with shipping companies, getting options on the biggest, best ships that could be used for this purpose, and they're going to be ready to go. When market prices crash and we get to the teens, if that really happens, they're going to be ready to fill up several crude oil carrier ships with crude oil, and they're going to make a fortune, and they're not going to take any risk whatsoever in doing it. All you have to do in order to get in on that deal is have the resources to be able to just charter a crude oil carrier ship, fill it up with oil, and park it for a year. Not everybody can do that. It's really only the biggest hedge funds that have the wherewithal to put on a trade like that.
Well, maybe we don't have the resources to afford to charter a tanker, but we didn't use your swimming pool this entire winter. What if we just drain that puppy and fill it up with crude?
Well, Nathan, I don't know about the swimming pool, but I do actually have a friend of mine who is working on a poor man's version of this tanker trade, which he calls the container trade. And basically the way it works is you take a shipping container, those are the 40-foot long steel containers that are normally loaded onto the back of container ships, you fill it up with drums of crude oil and store it in your backyard. And there's some legal issues with that with respect to hazardous materials and whether or not you can store oil without having a permit to be in that business and so forth. But there are people who are actually enterprising enough to look at storing oil on their own property by getting a rented storage container and filling it up with drums of oil. I'm not ready to put that one on myself, but it's possible.
All right, so let's look at this from a commodity trader's perspective, or more precisely from the perspective of a commodity trader who doesn't have the resources to put on the tanker trade or the shipping container trade or even the swimming pool trade. Is this just a matter of waiting for front month WTI futures to bottom in the upper teens, and then you back the leverage truck up and you buy that contract there in the teens?
No, and I think that's exactly the mistake that a whole lot of people are getting ready to make. I've heard so many people talking about, boy, when we get oil prices in the teens, and I think it's coming, when we get that, I'm just going to pile in. I'm going to pile in. I'm going to go crazy. Well, pile into what? Let's take the April delivery contract as an example. Let's suppose that Art and I are proven right and that contract just crashes. And by the time we get to, let's say, 2 weeks from now in the middle of March, that April contract is trading all the way down at $17. How could that be possible? Well, the only way it could be possible, as far as I can tell, would be if there is a storage crisis where there's no place to put the oil and the price is just being forced drastically lower. If that were happening, that means that that front month contract's price would be dramatically lower than the next subsequent contract. So let's say April is trading at $17, May is trading at $23. So it's $6 higher to buy the May contract. Well, if you bought the April contract, come March 21st, that contract expires. You have to roll it forward into the May contract. So what happens if there's a $6 difference in price is you're effectively adjusting your entry cost. Now it's not $17 anymore. It's $23 is your new adjusted cost of entry. You wait another month. Let's say that May contract sells off to the point where there's a $5 spread in that May to June time frame. Now when you roll May forward into June, it's another $5 and your price has gone up to $28. If it's another $5 the month after that, you're going to be up to $32. So you're going to keep paying more and more because each time you have to roll that front month contract forward, you're increasing your effective cost of acquisition by whatever that difference is, whatever the contango is between those two contracts. So I don't think you'd want to buy the front month contract, even though that's the one that has the lowest price, because that's also the one that has the highest premium for rolling it forward to the next month. So contract selection is going to be just super duper important here. And I think that when the front month bottoms, it's likely to happen with record contango. So you're going to want to look at where is the upside? Where's the potential? What contract do I want to trade? I would say you want to go at least a year or two out in the term structure. Why do I say that? Because I want to pick a contract that I expect the market will have recovered by the time that thing comes to maturity. So I'm not going to have to deal with it falling into this deep contango situation at the last minute. Well, most people think this thing ought to be ending by the end of this year. Let's just assume everything takes longer than you think it will. So add a year to that. By the end of 17, I think that this current action should be over. We ought to have an OPEC price cut by then. There ought to be a whole new regime in play. So if I look at the December 17 contract, I kind of like that one as a place to play this, at least initially. Now, once you get to the point where there is a clear upside trend, the price is recovering. Let's say OPEC has announced a price cut, and all of a sudden prices are really starting to recover. At that point, I think you would want to backroll out of that longer dated contract into the front month, because the front month will be transitioning from deep state of contango back towards a backwardation condition. That means the front month is going to perform best. But you don't want to be there and just sitting on it as it rolls at what could be an enduring prolonged period of low prices. So you want to wait till the trend is in play before you move back into front month futures. And until then, I think you want to be probably looking at later dated contracts, at least December of 17, because you're going to avoid the big contango drop between from 1 month to the next that would exist if you were holding the front month contract.
So when we're talking about trading the futures outright here, this is a little difficult because first we're talking about calling a bottom in anything, notoriously difficult. And second, we're talking about contract selection, a hyper-focus on the contract selection and where are you going to put your money and where's the value there. What about other options, specifically option? You know, as opposed to going outright long using the futures market, what about calls on the longer-dated futures?
Well, that's definitely a big part of this play, and I spend a lot of time thinking about the trade-off between outright futures, you know, long outright futures versus buying calls on futures. Now, the problem is, obviously, the upside to calls is you are limiting your loss. You can't possibly lose more than 100% of the call premium. So once you bought that call option, And there's some pretty decent looking call options already. If you start looking at 2018 December at, say, a 50 strike or so, I believe it's got to be above 50 by then. So that ought to be in the money by then. And, you know, those options are reasonably priced now. But the thing is, you're paying through the nose for volatility, because what determines the price of an option more than anything else is volatility in the market. The longer dated that option is, the longer its duration, the more expensive that volatility cost is. So let's suppose that prices are going to go down to $18. I'm just pulling this number randomly out of a hat, and stay there for a year. They're just not going to move. They're going to stay flat at $18. Well, what would happen would be the call options would continue to decay dramatically in value. And the reason that would happen is because the market is losing its volatility. The implied volatility that exists at the time that the market bottoms will be much higher than it will be several months later. Now, will the price also have gone up during that time, suggesting you wanted to jump on that option right when you had the chance at the lowest price? Or are you better off to maybe wait out the market in order to wait for that volatility to come out, which affects the cost of those calls? Maybe the underlying price is edging up slightly, but the cost of the call that you want to buy is still coming down because volatility is coming out of the market. So if you're going to look at calls on futures contracts, I think it's a very smart way to play this, but you've got to look at a little bit of time lag. I would be looking initially when I think the market has bottomed at whatever I'm going to do in outright futures. I would do that first and give it a little bit of time. See if some of the volatility coming out of the market improves the price of those call options, even as the underlying stays constant.
So given the current volatility that we're seeing in the oil market, it might not be the best time to be playing the options. You might get a cheaper price at a later date, basically.
Exactly. Especially if you think, as I do, that prices are going to move much lower. I don't think there's going to be a instantaneous V-shaped recovery. Now, certainly, at some point, when we get an OPEC production cut, not freeze, but production cut, when that deal really and truly is made, and I think it's still a long ways off, that's when prices start going straight up, and that's when you want to get out of those long-dated contracts into the front month, which is going to benefit the most from the market sort of celebrating a hallelujah moment that the oil rout is over. I don't think we're there yet. And if your expectation, as mine is that prices are going to go down, find a bottom, and kind of stay there without really recovering very quickly, that suggests that if I'm right about that, you could wait it out and get a better price on those options after the price has been lingering at $18 for a month than you would have gotten the first day that it fell to that level.
Okay. Now, let's say that I'm not eligible to trade futures or options. Let's say I'm running an institutional fixed income book and I want some exposure to this bottoming of oil prices, you know, but I can't trade the futures, only bonds. How am I going to play this?
Well, I think the first question I would ask in that scenario is, how broad is your investment mandate? Are you allowed to be both long and short fixed income instruments, or are you long only? Because if you can be short, then I think you're late to the table. You should have been playing this already by buying credit default swaps on shale-issued junk bonds months ago, because that play has performed extremely well, and you really want to have gotten into that already. It's a little bit late, but there may still be more to play on the downside there.
Eric, can I just stop you really quick and have you explain to everybody what a credit default swap is and why you'd want that as a way of expressing your short position?
Sure. A credit default swap is basically an insurance policy. If the bond that you hold doesn't pay off, if the people that owe you money, who issued the bond, default on it and never pay you back, a credit default swap is an insurance policy that makes sure you get paid back anyway. The way that it works, that's a little bit different from a regular insurance policy. If I'm talking about fire insurance, I can buy fire insurance on my house and I'm covered. I can't buy fire insurance on your house because I'm speculating. I think you're a reckless guy. You're the kind of guy who I think is going to burn his house down, so I'm going to buy fire insurance on Nate's house. I can't do that. You can do that in fixed income markets. You can buy credit default swaps on bonds that you don't own. So it's a good way. Now, it's possible to short those bonds, but the credit default swap is, in my opinion, a better, more efficient way of essentially betting against a bond, betting that it's going to fail. Because if there's a credit event, if there's a default, you end up getting paid as a result of that. And it's as soon as a determination is made by ISDA, the organization that oversees all this stuff, that the credit event happened, you're basically assured of getting paid at that point. So I like credit default swaps as a way of playing the short side. What I would be doing if I was a fixed income guy here is I would already be playing the CDS on the worst of the junk bonds that I could find. And what I would do is hire a guy like Art Berman to look at it from an oil standpoint, which is to say, how much revenue is really going to be there behind a certain batch of bonds? You know, what are the wells that are behind them? How, you know, what are their production rates? Do all the geology analysis of how much oil is really going to get produced by what's backing these bonds. And then I would do some financial analysis. I'd probably use another consultant on it. And I would be building a short book, which I would express through credit default swaps. But you know what's going to happen, just as happened during the 2009 event with mortgages. All of a sudden, mortgage-backed security is a four-letter word. And it doesn't matter what the fundamentals are. Nobody wants anything to do with it. I expect the same thing is going to happen with shale issued junk bonds, and there'll be some good ones. There'll be guys that have no risk of going out of business, that actually manage their businesses intelligently and have strong balance sheets and are not going to default on anything. And those bonds are still going to get dragged down with everybody else because most of the market is just selling with the broad brush shotgun approach of, we know there's a lot of risk there. We don't know where it is. Just sell everything. So I think that when you could start to find those jewels in the rough, now you're building a long-short strategy where you have both shorts and longs, and eventually you transition into a pure long position where you've gotten rid of all your shorts, you've hopefully profited from some of those credit default swaps, they've hedged your downside risk, and you've chosen the best of those credits and bought them on the cheap when the carnage is over. I don't think the carnage has really started yet, so the buying on the cheap, I don't think we're there. I think it's late to the game at this point to start building a short book and start building CDS or buying CDS on energy-related junk bond issues, but I think that that opportunity still exists. It's not time yet to play the other side of this, the long side of it. At least I don't think it is.
So given that, what else could potentially affect credit markets? Do you see any other risks out there to the banking system that might spur these banks to make, you know, premature cash calls for these shale issued junk bonds and this sort of thing?
Well, so far we're seeing the opposite. I think everybody wants for there not to be a subprime-like blow-up in the shale space. We've heard rumors that regulators are kind of telling the banks to do what they can to give the shale guys a break, not to enforce too harshly on them. I don't think any of that's going to matter. I think we're headed towards a massive wave of defaults. That massive wave of defaults will come after Art and I are proven right about another large move down in oil prices. So far, we're losing that battle. The spin doctors are winning. I don't think that the arguments they're making about a production freeze make any sense whatsoever, but they're holding oil prices high, and we need to wait and see what happens.
All right, well, now let's suppose for a moment that I'm an equity portfolio manager and I can only trade stocks. Again, I can't trade the commodity itself. How am I going to play this?
Well, in this case, we've got a little bit of a conundrum because history teaches us that normally the stocks tend to smell out problems and lead the fixed income markets. So you would expect to see the turnaround happen. You know, the bottoming should happen first in stocks and the turnaround should happen first in stocks. I don't think it's going to play out that way this time. And the reason I say that is I think that the trouble that I see coming in credit markets, most people are underestimating how bad it's going to be. I think that when the wave of defaults hits, all of a sudden there's going to be a real panic. And that's where you're going to get your capitulation low in stocks. So I think the energy stocks are going to first get nailed with the next move down in oil prices. Everybody's going to say, oh my God, that's it. this is the bottom in oil prices. This has to be the bottom in oil stocks. And I think that's the false buy moment where people are going to go piling in. There's going to be a bounce off of that level, whatever it is. But then I think the wave of credit defaults is going to come back to haunt the equity market, and that those credit defaults are going to result in a lower low. Now, I'm lining up a lot of dominoes there, Nathan. I don't know if it's really going to play out that way. You'd have to keep a close eye on it and see how the market develops. But that's kind of the way that I see things developing. So if I were an equity manager, similar to what I said for fixed income, first of all, if I had the mandate flexibility to be short, then I'd already be massively short energy stocks. Shale drillers that have no way of servicing their debt is exactly who I would be shorting here. And then I would look to turn that into a long-short strategy and eventually transition all the way to an outright long position after the carnage. And I don't think the carnage has even really begun yet. I think we're going to have a really big shakeup in the shale patch. And everybody knows it's coming, but I think most of them are underestimating how bad it's going to be.
So this is a capital story. This is about who has the capital and will be able to acquire distressed assets on the cheap, and who can acquire their competitors, and who will have no choice but to be acquired once they run out of money and they run out of funding.
That is exactly right. And if I had to say anything about 2016 in the energy market, it would be it is the year of capital. It is going to be about who's got the money and the knowledge to step in and say, okay, that distressed asset right there that this bankrupt company doesn't know what to do with, I want it. And I know what it's worth, and I was waiting for it, and I was ready to play vulture and make my move and get it on the cheap. That's who's really going to win here, are the people who are well capitalized and know the business well enough to know what's worth buying on the cheap and what isn't. It's going to be a major year of acquisitions and mergers. And I think that from an equity standpoint, if you have the wherewithal, if you're big enough that you can hire a team of consultants, guys like Art to do the oil side of this, balance sheet guys to really dig into the various shale operators, who are going to be the survivors that carry this industry forward into its second coming, which definitely is coming someday. It's still a few years down the road. Those guys are going to be super big wins. The problem is you're talking about betting on the winners, the survivors of the coming carnage. You don't know who survived until the carnage is over. And the way that I look at this is kind of hurry up and wait. Let's see what happens in this space. People who are smarter than I am, that are taking this, who have more resources than I am, are trying to figure that out ahead of time. Who's going to fail? Who's not going to fail? Putting their bets on early. I would be looking at it from an equity standpoint, more from the standpoint of we've still got a ways here. The price has got to bottom, which I don't think has happened. Then the credit markets have got to experience their default wave, which I think will be worse than most people think is coming. Then equities are going to bottom. So we've still got a ways. And I think that if you want to try to play the short side of it, you're a little bit late getting to the table now, but there's still room to do that. The long side of it, I think it's not till after credit bottoms that we see equities bottom. That is a little bit backwards from what you would normally expect in terms of how equities tend to lead other markets. I think in this particular case, it might go a different way, but that's just my guess.
All right. So in your discussion with Art Berman, Art suggested that these shale operators do not have cash. They have massive amounts of debt. And what they do have in the way of assets is their equity. And if that equity price starts to decline, what is that going to mean for the associated bonds?
Well, and you also have to consider that if the bonds default, the equity is going to be wiped out. So what I think these guys are doing is they're playing an interesting game. They don't have the money to pay back the principal on that they borrowed with these bonds. It ain't going to happen. It is unlikely that they will be able to get another round of financing and just roll that over and roll it forward. So what they're doing is they're all acting like, oh, servicing my debt is no problem. I can make my payments with the revenue that I'm making on oil. It's all fine. They're all in this extend and pretend game where they're acting as if there's nothing really wrong. The reality is when they get to the point of having to repay the principal on those bonds, they're not going to be able to do it, and they'll be forced to do something else, either be acquired by somebody who's got more cash flow and the ability to, you know, the creditworthiness to roll forward that debt into a new set of bonds, or they've got to see some recovery. I think a lot of these guys are hoping that the market is going to magically recover and their cash flow will be enough that they will be able to service their debt. I think that's unrealistic, wishful thinking. So at some point, we get to the point where not only is the credit market figuring out that these guys can't service their debt, but the equity market is figuring out that they can't service their debt. And presumably, if the equity is subordinate to the interests of the bondholders, that means the equity is in lots of trouble. I think it's only when the true extent of how big these credit problems is really learned that that's the point where equity collapses and you get a true bottom.
And we're seeing massive new issuance of shares from these shale operators. So it's all not painting a pretty picture for these companies. But I know that a lot of our listeners are retail investors and they're looking for ways that they can play this. And maybe they're not interested at all in the commodity futures market. Maybe they're only interested in equities. I don't know. But there are so many energy-related ETFs to choose from that it can be a little daunting to understand all of the options. Can you help us sift through some of them, please?
Sure. Coming at this from a retail investor's perspective, my first advice is don't be in a rush. This thing isn't over yet. I don't think you want to rush off to buy XLE or OIH or especially not something like USO, which is the ETF that directly invests in commodity futures. It's not over yet. Listen again to last week's show with Art. We think we've got a couple of months and at least $10 of downside before the market has really reached a bottom. When it gets there, don't buy an ETF like USO. It has exactly the same contango roll problem that we talked about in why you shouldn't buy the front month futures contract. If that seems a little bit complicated or hard to follow, summarize it to say when the price of oil goes up, the USO ETF doesn't go up as much because of this roll forward problem of the price changing every month. So you don't really want to look only at something like USO. I would look at USO after a clear uptrend is in play where the contango is coming out of the market and we're shifting back into a backwardation term structure. That's where you want to be long the front month. And that's where the USO ETF would give you the right kind of exposure as a retail investor. So I would be taking the strategy of make sure that you wait until the bottom is really in. I don't think we're there yet. I would start looking at, ideally, if you have the resources and the time, maybe investing in a newsletter or something so you can start to form your own list of companies that you think are going to be the winners and start buying those individual stocks. If you don't want to take that approach and you want to go with just an ETF like XLE, which gives you a simple one-stop shopping way to buy energy stocks all in one place, now you're getting the good, bad, and the ugly all in one package. You would be better off if you could discriminate and make up your own short list of stocks that you want to buy. But an ETF like XLE is probably a good second choice. Another good choice would be OIH, which is an ETF which is not oil companies, but oil service companies. That's like Halliburton and the companies that do the fracking and put the casings on deep water offshore wells and all this high-tech stuff. We're going to need, as we move further into this era of peak cheap oil, we're going to need more and more of these high-tech fancy services that make it possible to produce oil in all these newfangled ways. These guys have just taken an absolute killing. Their stocks have been beaten up, and they're companies that have a very, very sound future. We're going to need their services. So OIH is definitely an appealing one. But again, wait until the bottom is in. I think we've got a ways to go until we get there. And I would consider both equity and fixed income exposures that match your investment goals. There are likely to be some shakeouts in the high yield fixed income space including a bunch of defaults. If you can find the quality list of shale-issued debt that didn't default, that's going to be just fine, you're probably going to be able to get it at a very attractive yield because those bonds sold off along with a whole bushel full of bad apples, then everything sells off at once. If there were a couple of good apples in the bushel, you're going to be able to get them at a distressed price by taking advantage of understanding the mechanism of what's going on. So my biggest advice to retail investors is don't be in a rush. I don't think it's over yet. I don't think the big, you know, oh my gosh, the bottom is in, it's time to buy moment has happened. I could be wrong about that. If I'm wrong, it will be because the spin doctors have succeeded at overcoming the fundamentals and talking the market higher, which this week they've certainly been very successful at. I don't know if that's going to continue or not, but it might. And I would say just remember that this is a very volatile environment. When you think the bottom is in, especially in terms of the oil price, you know, because it dropped to $16, it doesn't mean it can't go to $8. It won't stay there very long. These are unsustainable prices already at the level that we're at. But I think they're going to continue to move lower until the oversupply is eliminated. When that is eliminated, we're looking at the buying opportunity of a lifetime. And I think it's going to be an incredible opportunity for a lot of people to make a lot of money.
So just to clarify, I know that ETFs are a popular product for the retail investor. You don't have to do a lot of work. It appears to be a simple and easy option to get exposure to various market movements. And USO has been one of those that has been very popular. This entire downside move that we've seen in oil has been bought at various stages by retail investors using USO, saying, this is the bottom right here. I've got to get in right here. For sure, it's going to go above 50. You know, it's not going to go below 50. It's not going to go below 40. It's not going to go below 30. We've seen all that play out. But I just want to summarize the difficulties with having long exposure to the futures market, whether you're using an ETF like USO or you've got direct exposure by buying the futures outright in a contango market, is that roll forward premia. So if we were shorting USO on the way down in this market that had the same contango conditions, that would be beneficial for us, correct?
That's right. Contango is a short seller's best friend. When the market is in contango, a short seller is automatically getting a free bump, whatever that difference is between the prices. You're making that as a free profit every month. The other guy, the long in the contango case, or the short in the backwardation case, the other side of the trade is going to be the opposite of that. So you're going to be losing money every month if you're long in a contango market or short in a backwardation market.
All right. Well, as we wrap up this analysis of the trading strategies for the coming low in oil prices, is there anything else that you want to add, Eric?
No, I think that, you know, the overall advice is just be careful. Remember that it is the OPEC production cut that changes everything. It is coming. Saudi Arabia cannot go forever without caving into this. They have to eventually agree to it, and it will change everything almost overnight. What we're seeing right now is a huge bump up in prices. That bump up in prices is based on people thinking that we're coming into that moment of the OPEC production cut. I think they're going to be proven wrong, but it might take until the 20th of March when we have this silly meeting about production freezes before people figure out that production freeze and production cut are not the same thing. So you don't know how long it's going to go. There's plenty of people with very strong agendas to try to manipulate the market and cause an outcome to happen here. It's just a question of understanding where we are, and I think that investors stand to do very well. When you make your long play, be ready to ride out some volatility. You're catching a falling knife here. You're trying to buy the bottom of an extremely volatile market. You might be off by a little bit and have to ride a J-curve, as they call it. You know, price goes down before it goes up. But in general, you're looking at oil prices, as Art said, the all-time low, if you do it on an inflation-adjusted basis, is about $16.50. Right now, we're at $35. We've been as low as 26 and change. I think we're going to get down to low 20s, if not teens, before this is over. And when we do, the opportunities are going to be tremendous.
All right. Well, on that note, let's go ahead and wrap up our coverage of the trading strategies on how to play this coming bottom in oil prices. But please stay with us, listeners, as Macro Voices continues right after this.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for future show topics or interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can also send our hosts your questions and suggestions for the program by emailing mailbag@macrovoices.com. Now, with this week's mailbag, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
All right, Eric, forum user D. Gilmart sent us one mailbag question for this week, and he writes, "For quite some time, the oil prices and the stock market have been almost perfectly correlated. Commentators have even begun assigning causation, saying things like, the Dow is down a lot today because of another drop in oil prices. Indeed, it seems psychologically to drive the market lower when oil drops. This makes no sense whatsoever to D. Gilmart. Unless you're in an energy firm with exposure to oil prices, dropping oil prices seem to be good news. How could lower oil not be good news, both to companies with energy as a major cost, but also to any company benefiting from extra dollars in consumer pockets? Have you been able to make any sense of this correlation? Is there a reason, or do we just give up thinking about fundamentals in the stock market altogether?"
Well, hi, Doug. This is a question that I think about a lot, and I don't think it has a good answer. And the reason I haven't adjusted on the show previously is because I'm guessing. I don't know what the answer is, but here's my guess. I think what's going on here is that for reasons that our listeners now understand after last week's show with Art Berman, the oil market is being pushed down to extraordinarily low numbers as a result of crazy circumstances. We had a malinvestment in the shale patch resulting from Fed easy money policy. We had a unexpected decision from Saudi Arabia not to cut production, but to instead focus on preserving market share. That has led us into this oversupply situation that's going to force oil prices down to just incredible low numbers. That's what we understand, you and I, Nathan, and our listeners after these last couple weeks of shows. Most people don't know that, though. The average investor is just looking at the big picture and they say low oil prices and low treasury yields are signs of an oncoming recession or depression. And I think that what's happening is the market is looking at low oil prices and saying, boy, that is signaling a coming depression or recession. I don't think they're right about that. I think that the situation in the oil market is kind of unique and special, and it's really about the crazy circumstance that we got ourselves into with too much overinvestment in the shale patch and a number of factors that we've talked about for the last couple of weeks. So I think that what's going on is the broader market is incorrectly assuming that low oil prices are a signal of general macroeconomic disease. And I think that the combination of low oil prices and low treasury yields is panicking the market into surely this must mean that there's a recession coming. Now, I don't think that's what it means. I do think there's a recession coming anyway. So, you know, they'll be proven right, even if they were wrong. But I think that's what's going on here, and it doesn't make sense to me. I don't think it should be going on. I think that the equity market is misinterpreting what the crude oil market is telling it.
All right, well, thank you for that question, Doug. And our second question comes from forum user and listener V. Soares, which I'm going to paraphrase here in the interest of time. V. Soares heard you and Art Berman talking about a coming wave of defaults on the junk bonds issued by shale producers. And Art even went so far as to say it will be a bloodbath. And if this is the case, speaking in nominal terms, how does the total size of shale-issued junk bond debt compare to the size of the pool of mortgage-backed securities largely responsible for the crisis of 08-09? And in the event of a shale-triggered credit event, should we expect a similar effect on equity markets?
Well, it's an excellent question, first of all. And I actually read an interesting piece of trivia on this. Believe it or not, the shale-issued junk bond market is bigger already than the subprime mortgage-backed security market was in 2008. Now, there's an important caveat to that, Nathan, which is that everybody thinks about subprime as where all the problems were in 2008. In reality, subprime was only part of it. There were several other tiers of mortgages that defaulted. And when we say subprime, those were the worst of the mortgages. The subprime tier, the worst ones, was actually smaller than the junk bond tier that we have in the shale patch. I think it's a little bit different in terms of who the holders are. There were a lot of holders of those mortgage-backed securities all over the world, pension funds, so forth. I think it's a little bit more concentrated in institutional holders. I think that a lot of banks are really screwed. The banking industry's exposure to risk from the shale patch is very high here. So it is big. I don't have a number in terms of how many billion dollars it is. I'm sorry. I wish I had that data for you. But it is big. It's a lot. And I think it's going to be mostly unserviceable. And the question is, how does it get worked out? Do we have outright bankruptcies with auctions for oil wells? Or does this look more like the industry recognizes the problem and the banking industry works it out and all of these things get renegotiated on more favorable terms or something like that going forward? We don't know yet. We'll see what happens.
Hopefully all parties involved have learned a lot from 2008-2009 in terms of how to handle this credit event should it unfold the way that you and Art and a lot of analysts are expecting. That's all we have for questions for this week. But if you guys like this segment being included in the program, if you guys have more questions, let us know. And just a reminder, send your questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. Eric, I think that's a wrap on this week's show. I really hope our listeners enjoyed this two-part series on trading the coming bottom in oil prices.
I hope so, too. And thanks, everybody, for your understanding. When we broke this topic up into two shows at the last minute, we just didn't know what hit us, and it was not possible to get another guest on this week. I think that worked out really to everyone's advantage. I wanted to talk about my strategy here. I would love to do a part three of this series at some point. I'd like to get somebody really big, an Andy Hall, say, who's a very highly respected oil trader with a very bullish outlook. I'd love to get somebody with an opposite side of mine and Art's view, but somebody with some credentials in the industry. We're going to keep working on that as a maybe, but in the meantime, we're going to get back to our normal program of bringing you interesting guests every week. So we've got Grant Williams coming for you next week by popular request, and we're really excited about the direction that Macro Voices has taken.
Definitely really excited to talk to Grant next week, and we've got a bunch of other big names lined up for you guys over the next couple of months, so please stay tuned. I think that's going to do it for this week, folks. We'll see you again next week, of course, and meanwhile, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. This really helps us make it possible to recruit the best names in the business as future Macro Voices guests. Please follow us on Twitter @MacroVoices, and take care of yourselves, everybody. We'll see you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.